Welcome to the Darrell McClain Show. I'm your host, Darrell McClain, and let's get into our episode.
Simply search for the T-Bone and Chick Brew podcast, available wherever fine podcasts are sold.
The Darrell McClain Show is fully listener-supported, independent media that won't lead you to tribalism. You can get a membership for as little as $3 a month at www.patreon.com/TheDarrellMcClain Show.
We talk about a lot of serious topics on this show. One very serious topic is women's health. One company that stood out to me was VSlay.com because the owner is very transparent about her own struggles in the women's health department and has great customer service, great deals, and frequent sales. You can check her out, her great customer service, products about women's health, and frequent sales at www.VSlay.com. That is www.VSlay.com.
So welcome to the show, guys. If you have been paying attention to the trial, Kyle Rittenhouse is now on trial. It has proceeded and he is testifying, which I actually do think is very good when somebody who's accused of something testifies. Just as a bit of background, Mark Richards, Kyle's lawyer, started by asking him questions about his ties to Kenosha. Rittenhouse then lists several family members who actually lived there, including his father. He had been accused of coming into a community that isn't his and contributing to the tensions there, of course. Now, Richard also asked Rittenhouse what he was doing in Kenosha on August 24th and 25th during the protests in the aftermath of the Jacob Blake police shooting. Rittenhouse described how he and several others went downtown to actually clean graffiti. Kyle Rittenhouse actually idolized the police and styled himself as an emergency medic. He arrived in downtown Kenosha on August 25, 2020, with at least one mission in mind, to play the role of a police officer and medic, joining a group of other armed civilians roaming the city streets, offering medical attention to strangers and protecting buildings from rioters. The night would end with Mr. Rittenhouse, who is 17, engaging in violence himself, fatally shooting two men and wounding others. Hours later, he turned himself into the police in Illinois, where he lived. So, this is actually more complicated than I think people initially thought when they first heard about a 17-year-old kid with a gun and that he had killed other people. I think everybody's normal reaction was, what was a 17-year-old doing with a gun? When you found out that it was a rifle, in a lot of states, when you turn a certain age, you can actually own rifles. A lot of states is 16, some is 18. But either way, the biggest question that was on a lot of people's minds were, was it self-defense or was he somebody who was a vigilante of sorts going out there to kill Black Lives Matter protesters? Unpopular opinion, it actually, by everything that I have seen, and if you go and review the videos that have been out for a year, I think that Kyle Rittenhouse has a very good chance of winning this case. as a self-defense mechanism, because from the videos I have seen, it does look like he was attacked first and he was responding. So that is a, even though it's somebody's life and it's hard to say that's the small potatoes, but the larger thing is the sadness of how, because of the polarization that we have in these countries over things like police brutality and the subsequent protesting of these things, you have radicalized a 17-year-old where he feels like it's his job to go clean up a community. If it was his normal intention to just go clean it up and clean up graffiti, that's even a problem, because that is not supposed to be the job of a 17-year-old child. A 17-year-old is supposed to be, for all intents and purposes, growing up and living life and having fun and hanging out with friends, not at protests with rifles and a medical kit, because us adults have fucked things up so much that they have to go and respond. This debate about police and the use of force, and whether it is indiscriminately used against a particular race more than others, we've been having this conversation since before Methuselah. And it's a shame to me that we still haven't figured this thing out. And now the fact that we have failed, people like Kyle Rittenhouse and other people, probably younger than him, are having to pick up the mantle and get engaged in this conversation that it seems is not ending. So the trial is going on right now. I'm going to post a link to it in the show notes of Kyle Rittenhouse testifying. He took the stand today and testified on his own behalf. And I will say that this was a bad situation. Whether it was a child whose parents drove him out of town to try to help with an event, or whether it was somebody who went there looking for trouble, this is just not what you would think about when you think about what a 17-year-old is supposed to be doing. Right now, this kid is supposed to be graduating high school and preparing to decide if he's going to go off to college. There's no reason he should have been in Kenosha protecting businesses. That is the job of the community. That's the job of the National Guard. That's the job of the police. And in listening to his testimony, you actually see that even the bulletproof vest that he had was issued to him by the police department. So I don't think that it's appropriate to demonize this particular gentleman, Kyle Rittenhouse, as if he was there with a intention to take lives. I think that when you get in those situations and guns are involved and emotions get high, sometimes these types of things are going to happen. And now, whether Kyle Rittenhouse gets off by means of self-defense or not, this young man's life has been changed. So let's transition to the economy and why millions of job seekers aren't getting hired in the job market. Now, according to the Washington Post, the United States has a record number of job openings, but many firms continue to favor candidates with several years of experience, availability to work evening or weekend hours, and willingness to work in person. Now, even as the United States has a near record number of job openings and companies complain that they can't find enough workers, some job seekers remain frustrated that they have not been able to get a job despite filling out dozens of applications daily on popular job sites like ZipRecruiter, Indeed, LinkedIn, and Craigslist. American workers are increasingly seeking higher pay, more flexibility, and remote options as they flex their leverage in the current job market. But many companies are not necessarily being more accommodative, continuing to favor candidates with several years of experience in the industry. More availability to work evenings or weekends hours are preferences for those willing to work in person. This mismatch in what both sides prioritize is yet another challenge complicating the country's economic recovery. helping explain weaker hiring in August and September. In many ways, supply and demand forces in the labor market are still out of equilibrium.
Your job? Well, you're not alone. A record number of people are quitting their jobs. In August alone, 4.3 million Americans quit their jobs. That's almost 3% of the workforce. In the midst of the pandemic, some workers have been worried about their health and access to childcare. But also, many service workers have left their jobs because they're poorly paid, thankless, or have a long commute. 892,000 workers left jobs in hotels, bars, or restaurants in August. And 721,000 workers quit retail. The trend reflects the fact that workers believe they can get better jobs. Many are seeking jobs that can be done remotely, have more flexibility, or just pay more. With 10.4 million job openings around the country as of the end of August, workers have choice and they have leverage.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
It goes without saying that this show does not happen without listener support. Support the Darrell McClain Show by going to www.patreon.com and getting a membership for $3. Or you can go to buzzsprouts.com/the Darrell McClain Show and hit the subscribe button and join there. Many ways to donate to the show. Independent media that won't reinforce tribalism. We have one planet. Nobody is leaving. So let us reason together. www.patreon.com/the Darrell McClain Show or go to Buzzsprouts and to the Darrell McClain Show and subscribe. Now, the Washington Post continues, while employers have complained for months about the difficulty they face hiring during a labor shortage, with more than 10 million job openings for 7.4 million unemployed workers, interviews with job hunting workers revealed a concurrent reality, the difficulty finding suitable work as they navigate the pandemic's labor market, the deep frustration among both hiring managers and job seekers right now underscores the challenges in getting so many people back to work quickly and growing the divide between what employees want versus what job seekers want. So employers, I think they meant to say. So anyway, a lot of interest from employers is not spread evenly across the labor pool. There are some people in a very high demand, and there are some people who get no interest at all, said Julia Pulak, chief economist at ZipRecruiter job site. Employers really do value prior experience a lot. Lavana Hampton spent years mixing drinks as a bartender at a popular nightclub in downtown San Antonio. But the pandemic has made her rethink her job. Hampton has seen COVID infections hobble and kill some of her friends, making her far less willing to take any risk. A friend's 70-year-old mother, who was like a second mom to Hampton, died last month of COVID after spending 3 months in the hospital. Another bartender that Hampton knows contracted COVID after returning to work and ended up in the hospital on a ventilator. Few in Texas wear a mask in bars and restaurants. Now, for months, Hampton, who's the age of 40, has been scouring job sites and for work from home positions and customer service and other fields so she won't have to return to bartending in a packed club. Quote, I have every right to work in a safe working environment, she said. I want to work from home. I want to keep safe. So the Washington Post continues, there's a growing preference for remote work among job seekers. Some 55% of people on ZipRecruiter actually reported looking for a job that would allow them to work from home. The vast majority said either the workplace safety concerns or child family care needs were driving their preferences for remote work. Hampton has not been able to land anything and is getting desperate since her unemployment ended over the summer. With no recent experience in many jobs she's applying for, companies are reluctant to give her a chance. She says, quote, I send out so many applications a day and nobody gets back to me. In the past 8 months, I've only had 3 telephone interviews, she said. It's affected my mental health greatly. I cry all the time. I've never been on unemployment before. Hampton is among 2.3 million Americans, about a third of the unemployed, who have been out of work for more than 6 months. The Labor Department refers to them as long-term unemployed. The nation has only had this many long-term unemployed twice before, during the Great Recession and during the early 1980s downturn. So I got Gene on the show again, our subject matter expert on things involving the economy. What do you think about just that snippet from the Washington Post?
Well, thanks. Hey, Daryl, how's it going? Thanks for having me back on the show. And that's just it. Snippet. Snippets have a lot of information in them that sound very impactful, but when you start to tear them apart or take a look in a different direction, you soon find out that those snippets aren't giving you the full picture. So 2-point-some-odd million people have been classified as long-term, I believe, unemployed. The economy supports a lot of different industry, clearly. People who train for certain jobs, train for certain employment, from doctor all the way down to whatever you can learn on the job training. So at any one point in time, there's always this 2-point-something million, 3-point-something million people who are working in an industry that is soon to change drastically and affect their position. It won't happen all at once, but to single out that this 2-point-something million people is significant, it's significant because it came to surface from the COVID pandemic. Again, it's always out there. It's always just waiting for another event to trigger it and make it happen. But I just wanted to say that the 2-point-something million, I wouldn't, clearly those people are affected at the individual level. It's a great concern to them. The benefits have run out. But I think that it's always important to kind of look at the numbers and say, oh, well, this could happen at any time. And so what do we do about that? And that kind of goes backwards into your comments earlier in the show about people quitting their jobs, and there's jobs for that aren't being filled, and people who discovered that the commute wasn't worth the paycheck, and they decided to just stop working. Some of them for many different reasons. Some shifted gears into other industries and got other jobs. I think it's kind of reflective of where we are. We've been working in this model for so long. Technology has pushed us out there. The model is changing. It's going to change even further. I'll stop there, but that's some color around all this.
And so what do you think about the 4.3 million people that left their jobs in August? I've heard people calling it the Great Resignation.
Yeah, I think the pandemic, the time that people had an opportunity to work at home remotely, for those who did, for the people who started getting some additional benefits from the government, federal and state, local, I think it gave people a chance to just slow down, change their behaviors. Their daily behaviors changed from there, and because the environment dictated that they do change. People are creatures of habit, or can be. So they're going to go day to day to day. They're going to keep getting in the car and driving to that job because they haven't thought about something different, not in mass, not to the tune of 4-point-something million people. People think about that on and off, but not all at the same time. The working remotely, the additional benefits gave people the opportunity to say, you know what, I don't need to be part of that 70% of consumer spending that keeps the American economy going. I don't need to go out every weekend or every order online or whatever it is to pull in more and more and more product that's imported from other countries. I don't need this anymore. I've got another way of life that I'm looking at now. And for some of those 4-point-something million people, that decision to switch and stop working altogether is something they embraced and welcomed. They wouldn't have had that opportunity otherwise in such a great number without the pandemic.
So can the economy be sustained without those workers, or people just coming in to replace them? And what can employers do to make I guess, to entice people to get back into these industries?
Well, economic sustainability is not dependent on just that component. There are multiple components which are constantly changing and in flux. Support economic stability, which is only exists for a certain period of time, because obviously it's a cycle, business cycles, troughs, peaks, cool downs, heat ups, inflation, deflation. That's all, you know, very textbook, if you will. But I think that to just segue quickly into the employer piece of this, employers are already out there making a lot of significant changes. But I want to say this about employers. A company is only able to make the changes that benefit its stakeholders, whether it's their the consumer, the investor, the employee. They can only make these changes if they are a good functioning company that's well capitalized, doesn't carry a tremendous amount of debt that they can't quickly dissolve in the event of unforeseen economic downturns or a shift, if you would, in the supply chain and resources, cost of doing business. So those companies, for example, are already pushing wages up to minimum wage up to $18 an hour within their organization. Those companies are already announcing that there will be no hard return back to the office, that some employees will be identified as must work in the office because of the positions they hold. And they know this themselves. Employees will be allowed to collaborate with management and colleagues to have a hybrid type of back to work. I think if you think about the output that companies expect from an employee, they pay them for that output, but they don't pay them just for the output that they give at that point in time. They want three times the output. I'll just use that as a variable, so that they have the benefit of the extra output from the employee. So companies are also giving employees. There's models out there, some excellent companies. I'm not going to name names, but there's some excellent industry leaders out there who are giving their companies the power. The employees are making the decisions. The employees are deciding this is how the company is going to be run. Any good company that has that kind of culture and can attract that kind of talent and keep it, board of directors might want to be board of directors might be looking over their shoulders because they could become obsolete.
Oh, wow. Thank you, Gene, for a thorough answer on that. So I did put the article is about a 12-minute read, so there's a lot more left. I put it in the show notes for everybody that wants to read it in its entirety. And if you'd like to listen, the Washington Post does have a audio section where you can listen to the article in full. So let's transition to something different. The U.S. overdose deaths are soaring, and Biden's new plan could help ease the crisis. So nearly 100,000. So every time I say or read that number, it shocks me again. Stanford University addiction researchers Keith Humphrey said the United States death toll from drug overdoses between March 2020 and March 2021, there is nearly 100,000. The number is 30% more than the previous 12-month period. It is a record high, and yes, it should be shocking. So it's good that the Biden administration is taking steps to ease a crisis that is shattering families and communities. Secretary of Health and Human Services Xavier Becerra has rolled out a four-part plan that includes measures to prevent drug addiction by cracking down on inappropriate prescribing of opioids and to curb drugs overdoses by emphasizing harm reduction techniques. These include federal support for distribution of clean syringes and test strips to check street drugs for hidden fentanyl. Quote, we are willing to go places where our opinions and our tendencies have not allowed us to go before. Mr. Berker said in an interview with NPR on the decision to embrace policies that in the past have been met with resistance. Providing such support to drug users has been criticized as enabling and encouraging use of illegal narcotics. But the data from programs operated by nonprofits and grassroots groups in the United States and those in other parts of the world suggests harm reduction strategies are effective in lowering death rates and transmission of diseases. The administration is right to treat addicts less like criminals and more like people in need of treatment. Quote, their logic is the right logic, Mr. Humphreys told NPR, is what you do when you have a epidemic of addiction. You try to keep people from becoming addicted. You try to keep people alive. You try to keep the people alive, the people you can't treat. You try to get them into recovery. In an interview with NPR, Mr. Bursa initially suggested his agency might be open to the creation of overdose prevention sites where people can use illegal drugs under the supervision of trained staff who can offer counseling and intervene in the event of an overdose. But the department later walked that back, the comment because the Justice Department is involved in litigation over the legality of such sites. That's unfortunate. Such facilities have long operated in Canada and in Europe and have been credited with saving thousands of lives. That could not be ruled out as a possible tool. Well, it should not be ruled out as a possible tool. Now, the effectiveness of the plan outlined by Mr. Burka, which also concludes greater access to drug treatment, will depend upon Congress's willingness to provide adequate funding. The plan is accompanied by a request of $11.2 billion. But it is encouraging that opioids crisis lately both aggravated by the overshadowed by the coronavirus epidemic is getting attention that will hopefully result in meaningful action. So in the same vein, the Oklahoma Supreme Court has overturned a historic opioid ruling against Johnson & Johnson. So the Oklahoma's highest court reversed a historic ruling against drug maker Johnson & Johnson on Tuesday, finding a judge incorrectly interpreted public nuisance laws in the nation's first major trial over the opioid epidemic. Now, the 5-1 decision that overturned the $465 million verdict issued by the Cleveland County District Judge Thad Baughlin back in 2019 is a blow to the argument that companies that marketed, sold, and distributed opioids created a public nuisance and should abate some of the damage drugs have caused in those communities. Oklahoma communities alleged that they were inundated by billions of pills while people were becoming addicted and overdosing. A similar claim is being tested in courts by other communities nationwide that are suing companies arguing that they are in part responsible for public health crises that has killed more than 500,000 people in two decades. Now, companies scored a win last week in California when a judge said he would rule against several large counties arguing public nuisances claims because they had not proved deceptive marketing increased medically unnecessary prescriptions. Other cases hinging on similar arguments have not yet been heard or decided. For example, in West Virginia, a federal judge is considering his ruling in a case that centers on the public nuisance claims in which a hard hit communities allege distributions of opioids that were shipped to their area were without a regard for red flags. The distributors have themselves denied any wrongdoing. Quote, in reaching this decision, we do not minimize the severity or the harm that thousands of Oklahomans citizens have suffered because of opioids. The Oklahoma Supreme Court judges wrote in their ruling, however, grave the problem of opioid addiction is in Oklahoma. Public nuance laws does not provide a remedy for this harm. The one dissenting judge, James E. Edmondson, said he disagreed with the ruling against Johnson & Johnson, but thought the decision should be remanded to the lower court. Quote, today, the Oklahoma State Supreme Court appropriately and categorically rejected the misguided and unprecedented expansion of public nuisance laws as a means to regulate the manufacture, marketing, and sale of products, including the company's prescription opioid medications, Johnson & Johnson spokesman Jake Sargent wrote in a statement. Oklahoma Attorney General John O'Connor said that the 2019 decision was a huge victory for Oklahoma citizens and their families who have been ravaged by opioids, and he said he was disappointed in Tuesday's ruling. Our staff will be exploring options. We're still pursuing other pending claims against opioid distributors, and we have flooded our communities with these highly addictive drugs for decades. Oklahomans deserve nothing less, he said in a statement. The money from the decisions was used to abate the overdose crisis in Oklahoma. Because the ruling was on appeal, none of the $465 million has been given to the communities, Johnson & Johnson said. So public nuisance laws has evolved to cover a large miscellaneous group of offenses against the community at large. A loud party disturbing a quiet neighborhood or a factory's foul odor enveloping a city. Some local governments have made public nuisance claims against firms such as ExxonMobil, Chevron, and BP, arguing that carbon dioxide emitted into the atmosphere has contributed to climate change. The descendants of victims of the Tulsa Race Massacre have filed a public nuisance lawsuit seeking reparations for the destruction of the Greenwood, the city's thriving and affluent black community. Tuesday's decision in Oklahoma and the tentative ruling in California, both bench trials, should not be considered predictive of how other states' courts may interpret public nuisance laws and opioids, said Elizabeth Birch, a University of Georgia law professor who has followed opioid litigation. Quote, all these two outliners' opinions are, or are they trendsetters? Question, I think it's too early to be able to tell right now, she said. Still, the opinions could sway plaintiffs determining how to argue their cases or communities considering joining the national settlement announced in July. Birch said Johnson & Johnson agreed to contribute up to $5 billion in a $26 billion deal with the top three distributors, McKinsey, Cardinal Health, and AmerisourceBergen, to resolve thousands of opioid claims. At least eight states have rejected the deal with Johnson & Johnson. Meanwhile, the case against pharmacies and others remain ongoing, including one trial in federal court in Cleveland last month. There is a lot still left to be litigated, Bird said, and there's a lot that remains to be seen. So I think when it comes to the opioid crisis, this is something that connects a lot of communities. I think that there should be a bit of responsibility that should be held with the companies, but I also think that we have to somewhat also look at the medical establishment, the infrastructure that was pumping out these prescriptions. So it's not just that the makers of the drugs knew what the side effects would be, but if people are going to their doctors and other healthcare professionals that can write these prescriptions, and they were getting writing them, especially in places like Florida, extremely fast, I think it's about time that if you can't look at punishing some of these companies, you may have to do the harder thing and go after some of these individual doctors who became a bit of a prescription mills. I remember, and this is an oldie, back when even the late Rush Limbaugh had some back pain and was giving opioids, and he came out and said that the pills were so powerful and whatnot, he got addicted to them.
Let's talk about you. You said recently, I actually thank God for my addiction to pain pills, because I learned more about myself in rehab than I would have ever learned otherwise. What did you learn from drug rehab?
One of the things that I'd always had trouble with in my life was trying to be what other people expected me to be or wanted me to be in my personal life, because I wanted to be liked. You know, everybody's raised to want to be liked. and to want to be loved. Nobody wants to grow up being hated. Now, interestingly, my radio career, I don't care. You know, I figured that out. It was a tough thing, Chris, to learn to take as a measure of success being hated, you know, by 20 or 30% of the country. I mean, that's because nobody's raised for that. But in my personal life, the thing I learned most was that the only way to have real intimacy with people, real solid relationships, is to be who you are. That will attract the kind of people worthy of having intimate relationships with, good friendships with.
And without putting you on the couch, are you saying that the addiction came from some sense of personal inadequacy?
Of course, yeah. I wasn't good enough. I was masking unhappiness elsewhere, not dealing with the real reasons I was unhappy in my personal life. I had never experienced the kind of euphoria that I got from a pain pill. I think the only time that I really, with all the success I've had, the only time I've had that kind of euphoria is when I made the high school football team as a sophomore. I was never prouder of myself, but all my career achievements did not create that for me, because you got to maintain it every day. It's not something you earn, and then it lasts forever. And I don't look back. I don't stop and think about what I've accomplished, because there's always tomorrow. So I don't have time for the euphoria. I don't have time for the, man, am I something? I'm too busy trying to meet everybody's expectations tomorrow. So the pain pills came along and they masked all these feelings of inadequacy that I had. Now, after just 7 weeks of this place in Arizona, I have zero feelings of inadequacy. It's not been replaced by an irresponsible ego. It's just a confidence in who I am.
At any rate, thank you for tuning in today, and see you on the next episode. Of course, if you want to support the show, you can do so by going to www.patreon.com/TheDarrellMcLean Show, and see you on the next episode. Thank you for listening to today's episode. Of course, if you want to support the show, you can do so by going to www.patreon.com and getting a membership for as little as $3 a month. Again, that's www.patreon.com/TheDarrellMcLean Show. The Darrell McLean Show is fully listener-supported, independent media that won't lead you to tribalism. Get a membership and support independent media at www.patreon.com/TheDarrellMcLean Show.